Hello, I'm Lina Khmoudou. Welcome to Health Chat. June 4th marks the first ever World Day for Assistive Technology, aiming to raise awareness of the importance of assistive technology and promote better access worldwide. Get this, about 2.5 billion people today need at least one form of assistive technology, and most people will require assistive technology at some point in their lifetime, according to the World Health Organization. Assistive technologies are devices, technical aids, and the systems and services associated with them. From a simple pair of eyeglasses to a blood pressure monitor and a high-tech wheelchair, assistive technology helps people function every day with more autonomy and is a part of many people's lives. This includes people with chronic health disorders or physical impairments and the elderly. Experts say only 10% of people in low-income countries can access the assistive technology they need, compared with 90% in high-income countries. In Africa, 10 to 20% of the population faces disability challenges. Limited infrastructure and high costs for assistive technology create barriers to access, leading to exclusion. In ABLE, a non-profit group in Kenya and the USA, aims to make a difference by helping young people in Africa through technology.
Edwin Omulama is one of millions of people living with disabilities in Africa. He's here today to learn how technology can assist him in moving without the aid of someone or his walking stick. A device attached to his feet can prevent collisions, safeguarding him from injuries. At the Inclusive Africa Conference, at least 20 innovators display technologies designed to improve the independence of persons with disabilities. According to the United Nations, more than 80 million people in Africa are disabled. By 2050, 3.5 billion worldwide will need assistive technology. The devices displayed here are designed to address disabilities, from aiding communication for people with verbal and vision impairments, to facilitating easier movement. Faustina Urasa from Tanzania says being assisted into a vehicle can be very upsetting.
There are times when someone touches you in a way that makes you uncomfortable. But with this mode of transport, it helps preserve our dignity. I'm relieved that I won't have to be carried and touched anymore. Now I can enter the vehicle with respect and sit comfortably. It brings me immense joy.
Access to assistive technology is poor in Africa and is blamed on poverty, the environment, lack of knowledge, and lack of support services and service providers. Organizers and participants at the conference held in Nairobi this week discussed the challenges they face as disabled individuals and the costs and opportunities in assistive technology. As the conference ends, those living with disabilities and their advocates hope their voices will be heard and be supported by getting tools to better their lives. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
To find out more about assistive technology, we spoke with Pascal Bijlevel, he's CEO of 80Scale, the global partnership for assistive technology, and asked him to elaborate on the significance of the first World Day for Assistive Technology. Pascal Bijlevel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
World Day for Assistive Technology will be commemorated, or is commemorated, on June 4th. This is the first time that this is happening. What is the significance of this, and what is the message for this year?
I think the significance of this is that it is the first time, and it is a big step for this global movement that is trying to raise more awareness and understanding for the need for assistive technology. In case you're wondering, assistive technology is eyeglasses, hearing aids, wheelchairs, prosthetics, digital devices, anything that one needs to be functional and fully included in society. And it's been a neglected issue. So the idea of the World AT Day is to take a moment every year. This is the first, but there'll be many more, to really highlight this issue, mobilize political voices, mobilize civil society, mobilize individuals around this issue, and spread the word about the need for assistive technology and the huge inequity that still exists today in access.
Tell us, who is behind this first World Day to shed a light on assistive technology, and what specific outcomes are organizers hoping to achieve?
So we've mobilized a community of 30-plus partners behind this movement. We are, as AT Scale, as the Global Partnership for Assistive Technology, spearheading this campaign. But it really, it's not about AT Scale, it's about assistive technology. So we've got, you know, partners like the World Health Organization and UNICEF and UNOPS behind us, but we also have organizations like the International Disability Alliance or the South African Federation of Disabled People. We have governments behind this campaign. We've got a lot of NGOs and other actors, professional groups as well, that are backing this campaign. The Valuable 500 is another one that we're partnering with, who speak and sort of bring together also the voice of the private sector and their commitment to do more for accessibility and inclusion.
So you mentioned wheelchairs as one of the examples of assistive technology. Who needs assistive technology besides wheelchair, people that have disabilities? In general, is it something that everyone is concerned or should be?
That's a great point. And that is one of the key messages that we want to bring across here, is that assistive technology is about everyone. It tends to sometimes be limited. People just think, oh, this is about people with a disability. But even though they are an important user group, of course, and they often need more than one assistive technology. But if you think about the silver tsunami, you know, the growing population of older people, they will all need assistive technology as they grow older, a hearing aid, a wheelchair, or reading glasses, and so on and so forth. But we're also talking about just kids that may just need simple eyeglasses or a hearing aid to be able to participate in class and not be considered as someone who doesn't understand what's going on and then gets left behind, right? So, and those kids don't usually fall under the sort of the, or don't consider themselves as living with a disability, for example. So it really is about everyone.
Now, data show that there is a significant gap in access to assistive technology between low-income and high-income countries. What are some of the main barriers preventing people in low and middle income countries from accessing or affording assistive technology?
Right. So you've listed one of them. Affordability is a really important barrier to access. Right now, many of these products in the countries we work with are out of reach for individuals. And unfortunately, many very few governments are actually procuring assistive technology or including assistive technology in the basic health insurance package or the social protection package and so on. And so it makes it very, very difficult. And that's why a lot of people are left behind. But that's not the only reason. The related reason, and that's why we're doing this campaign, is just also this lack of awareness. All the way from individuals themselves who may need assistive technology but may not know they need it, or may not know it's available, or may not know where to go and get it, all the way up to, you know, leadership in governments who are decision makers about budgets and what to prioritize, who may not be really aware that this is an issue that's not been brought to their attention. They haven't maybe heard demand for it, and so on. And that's all because of this lack of awareness and understanding. And then you've got some more fundamental factors like a lack of human resources, a workforce. In some countries in Africa, there's maybe one or two audiologists for the entire country, right? And fitting a hearing aid does require some level of expertise to make sure it's the right one and it's fitted appropriately and it's adjusted and so on and so forth. Same goes with eyeglasses, same goes with wheelchairs. And so developing that workforce is also an important piece of increasing accessibility.
What innovative solutions are being developed to enhance global access? And what about Africa in particular? You mentioned the continent.
So you can think of innovation in different ways. One is the product itself, and there's a lot of innovation around the product itself. Obviously around digital assistive technology is an area where that's moving very, very fast. And smartphones is fast becoming one of the most important forms of assistive technology, in particular for people with visual or hearing impairment. That's, you know, really changing their lives in terms of being able to be more independent in their daily lives. You've got a lot of innovation around, for example, 3D printing opportunities, which then allows products to be more easily made and tailored at the local level in harder to reach areas. You've got technologies in terms of local innovations, right? And in Africa, there's a lot of local innovation happening to make products that are appropriate to the context. Now, many of these innovations, however, tend to be small scale, right? And the question is, how do you, you know, how do you support them to really become sustainable and viable solutions in the longer term? But you've also got that innovations in service delivery, which comes a bit with the enhanced technology, but that's allowing, for example, to do tele-rehab, so at a distance. So you don't necessarily need as many specialists across the country, thanks to telemedicine type services. Task shifting is another huge opportunity that is now becoming a possibility thanks to advances in technology. You can have now autorefractors handheld that doesn't require an ophthalmologist to kind of do.
Now, what can people do to really be part of the solution? We talked about access. Many people don't have access, but what can they do on an individual level or a community level to help with this challenge of access or perhaps affordability or getting the message out? What can they do?
I think as an individual, the most important thing that one can do is to talk about, to spread the word, to get the message out around this issue, and to, where possible, get organized and demand better services and better access, right? Raising that voice, organizing that voice. And you do have organizations of people with disabilities, for example, that are trying to do that. But like I said, it's about everyone. And so it's also about going beyond that particular a group, but raising that voice collectively as a community and pushing for inclusion. I think there's also very simple things that can be done to begin to overcome this, is fighting the stigma that is associated with it. So many people still believe that, actually wearing eyeglasses may make your eyesight worse, right? Or people are embarrassed to wear a hearing aid or those kinds of things. And that really happens at a community and individual level, and those changes can be made by everyone. And then, of course, you've got governments that need to really ramp up and live up to their commitments. They've all signed the Convention of People for the Rights of People with Disabilities, for example, but they're not implementing most of the commitments that are in there. And then you've got private companies that could be doing a lot more to make sure that not only are they, you know, developing products that are accessible, but also employing people that are AT users and making their premises more accessible, and then providing the assistive technology that people may need to be able to work as everyone else does. So many, different types of organizations and groups can do different things, and it all needs to happen together.
The AT scale and the Clinton Health Access Initiative have released a new report. What key insights and recommendations are highlighted in the report?
So the report is actually the idea behind the report is just to bring transparency to the market. This has been a challenge because it's a very fragmented market. Oftentimes we found that even where you have willing governments, organizations that want to procure assistive technology, they may not know where to get it, what kind, how much should they be expected to pay for it, and so on and so forth. And so this is really a catalog of what is available out there for the main types of assistive technology to provide much more transparency and openness and to make the market work better. It's just a first step in that effort. The next phase, immediately starting now, as soon as we've launched this report, is actually turning it into a web-based platform that will be more dynamic and regularly updated, because of course the situation changes quite often. And also including information about the demand so that it helps also the suppliers, the manufacturers, to better know what to produce and how much and so forth. So it's really about that transparency. That's what's groundbreaking, I think, in this sense.
For the World Day for Assistive Technology, you're working with celebrities like Amadou and Mariam. Talk to us about this collaboration and what sorts of impact you've seen or you hope to see them having in this dynamic.
So this is just starting, as you know, we are hoping that by bringing such people into this movement and being champions for this, it will again just open the eyes of many people that may not be, you know, just not aware of this issue, and so we're really counting on their voice and their music and their presence to really get that word across. We've also produced a short video that we will be releasing tomorrow that demonstrates the life-changing impact of assistive technology for individuals and their community. And we really want this to go viral. That would be, for me, the biggest success, is if we can get this video out there and watched by as many people as possible. And again, those champions that are supporting our cause will, I hope, help, you know, broaden that reach. And it's just a start. This is our first big event since launching the campaign in Davos, but there'll be many others to come.
Great. And any final words before we wrap?
Just to thank you and thank VOA for your interest and for helping us get the word out there as well. We need every voice. It's about doing this together. It's about trying to reach those sustainable development goals, right? I mean, it's about inclusion and bringing the quality of life that everybody has a right to, that everybody deserves. And it's about doing the smart thing. So just to thank you and your listeners and viewers.
Pascal Bigevaux, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Pascal Bigevaux, CEO of AT Scale, the global partnership for assistive technology. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. The air we breathe every day affects our health. According to the World Health Organization, pollution kills about 7 million people a year worldwide. The 2023 World Air Quality Report by IQ Air reveals that only 7 out of 134 reporting countries met safe air pollution levels in 2023, including Iceland, Mauritius, and New Zealand. In Kenya, students at a school right next to the country's largest dump site have planted bamboo to improve the air quality. Foul-smelling fumes from the waste is affecting the students' health. Now the school is fighting back.
Armed with gardening hose and bamboo seedlings, students gather at their school tree planting site. They're full of hope that trees they grow will filter the filthy air around the school. More than 100 bamboo trees dot the mini forest created around the Dandura Secondary School, located east of Kenya's capital, Nairobi, next to the country's largest dump site.
Some of the challenges that really affect us is the smell coming out from the dump site, the smoke, burning of those elements in there. Really produces smoke that also triggers asthma. Asthma is a disease that it's commonly known in the Dandura Secondary School.
Acrid smoke billows from the burning of refuse every morning, floating its way over to the neighboring school. This bamboo project is the school's way of fighting back.
My motivation of initiating bamboo project in the school was to mitigate the effects of dump site. It is really pollute the air that we breathe, and with that I know it is going to reduce the cases of respiratory infections amongst the people in Dandura community.
Dandura dump site occupies approximately 50 hectares of land and receives more than 2,000 tons of waste daily from around Nairobi, where 4 million people live. The dump site effects can be detected from kilometers away. Observers say Nairobi's air is often polluted by emissions from secondhand cars, and other pollutants include smoke from industries that are often located near residential areas. Idrana Mbandi is the Africa Regional Air Quality Expert at the United Nations Environment Programme, or UNEP.
The impacts of air pollution to all parts of our bodies, including our brains, our organs, including our lungs, actually impact on even children before they are born, young children. It is really the best way to ensure that you do not breathe polluted air is to minimize your exposure.
Bamboo trees are hailed as one of nature's finest air purifiers, according to UNESCO. The seedlings planted in August last year are slowly towering high against the suffocating fumes.
Now, planting bamboo trees ensures that there is a barrier that is provided in terms of the air that is polluted coming through, especially when you look at the fine particles. As well as, of course, the bamboo being a plant ensures that there's photosynthesis, and in photosynthesis ensures that it's producing oxygen, whereas also intaking carbon dioxide.
The WHO says air pollution kills about 7 million people in the world, and 99% of the global population were exposed to contaminated air in 2019.
We asked listeners to share their thoughts on the air quality in their communities and what can be done to improve it. Here are some reactions from the DRC.
There is air pollution here in Uvira, and this is due to several factors. One of the factors we see here is created by people, which is the cutting of trees. We also witness natural disasters such as floods that destroy homes, habitats, and can lead to the destruction of sanitation infrastructures.
We face some serious issues. The air quality we breathe here in Uvira is poor. We have noted it because there are three main factors that affect our air quality. There is also the issue with those who make charcoal. Additionally, part of the population in Uvira uses wood for cooking, which produces smoke that contributes to air pollution.
To improve air quality in a practical way, for example, the local or government authorities should take measures that will help improve the environment and improve air quality. What I mean by this is, for example, such measures could be to ensure that each person that owns a plot of land plants a tree.
These were reactions from Uvira in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Dr. Lisa Frost Ramsey is an air quality specialist at SLR Consulting and associate professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. She discusses the impact of air pollution on our health and steps to improve air quality in Africa.
Probably the best way to define bad air quality or poor air quality would be to look at the concentration of toxic air pollutants in the air. These can include particulates, so solid particles and gaseous compounds. And there's various health guidelines that are relevant. And if the concentration in the air goes above those guidelines, they can impact health. On the African continent, a key air quality issue is around indoor air quality. And a large number of households are burning indoors or are using stoves like paraffin stoves that do emit a lot of pollution. Houses are often poorly built, poor ventilation, and the pollution accumulates indoors. People sleep close to these sources of air pollution as well. Air pollution has very high impact on health. In fact, there's higher death rates related to air pollution than HIV and malaria combined. The most vulnerable are children and the elderly. The elderly, because their systems are starting to degenerate and they cannot process toxins as well as young people. And children, because their respiratory rates are very high. They breathe faster and more often than adults. And their bodies are small. So for the amount of toxins that they absorb, there's a greater effect. So children are very sensitive. Some of the key options would include developing air pollution control law, which is very necessary. And in some countries, we have law, but it's very poorly implemented. We need to establish what pollution people are being exposed to. So getting some monitoring networks, there's wonderful technologies coming out of India, for example, that are low-cost sensors that you can put out, you can measure air pollution, and you know what people then are being exposed to. You can't address the problem if you don't understand the problem first. Sometimes we're fortunate and you can see the air pollution. So for example, with smoke and very dusty sources like in mining areas, you can actually see the hazy or the dustiness in the air, and you know that you're being exposed. But some of the most toxic pollutants you can't see, and many of them you can't even smell, unfortunately. Also, it's quite difficult to say that if you're sneezing a lot, it's definitely air pollution, because it could also be an allergy. So when we're trying to link air pollution to health impact, we not only look at symptoms, such as sneezing or coughing or feeling nauseous or having headaches, we link that with exposure, which would be a measurement of air pollution in the air.
That was Dr. Lisa Frost Ramsey, Associate Professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. Major relief agencies warn time is running out for millions of people in Sudan who they say are at imminent risk of famine. Lisa Schlein has more.
19 global humanitarian organizations, including 12 United Nations agencies, today urged Sudan's warring parties to stop blocking food aid from reaching millions of people suffering from acute hunger. Jens Laerke is spokesperson for the Office for Coordination for Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA. He says heads of these agencies fear many of the 18 million acutely hungry people, including 3.6 million children, will die if the blocked relief pipeline isn't opened.
If they continue to be prevented from providing aid in Sudan rapidly and at scale, a famine will likely take hold in large parts of the country. More people will flee to neighboring countries. Children will succumb to disease and malnutrition. And women and girls will face even greater suffering and dangers.
Laerke notes acutely malnourished children are 10 to 11 times more likely to die than other children. Sudan, which is in its second year of conflict, is home to the largest number of internally displaced people in the world, nearly 10 million people who have been uprooted from their homes. Laerke says a further 2 million people have fled for safety to neighboring countries as refugees.
Attacks against civilians, including sexual violence, are multiplying, and hospitals and schools are also coming under attack. At the same time, aid workers face systematic obstructions and deliberate denials of access by parties to the conflict. Movements across conflict lines to parts of Khartoum, Darfur, Al Jazeera, and Kordofan have been cut off since mid-December.
This, he warns, would unleash catastrophic humanitarian consequences both in the city and across Darfur. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's all for today. Thank you for joining us and good night.